Why is the atonement necessary? Number 2 in the Cross Series. This is an exposition of Genesis chapter 18, verses 16 through 33. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, June the 15th, 2011.
R.C. Sproul made the comment that the cross was the ugliest, most obscene thing in the history of the world. Now, if you hear that quote out of its context, it's offensive. If you just hear somebody say that, it kind of sets you back. What does he mean that the cross is ugly and obscene? But though the cross is precious to us, though it is the heart and soul of our faith, and yes, I understand that we love the old rugged cross, because it's there that the dearest and best for the world of lost sinners was slain. So we do cherish the old rugged cross. But we do need to recognize that it was ugly and it is obscene. And the reason it is because the holy and spotless Lamb of God was made sin for us at the cross. The reason it's ugly and obscene is because every vile, putrid, hateful act of rebellion was placed on him. That's why God caused darkness to come on the face of the earth. He didn't want anyone looking on his son as he bore the sins of the world. It's there that the holy, righteous, burning wrath of God came in judgment of our sin. It's not nice, it certainly wasn't pretty, and it's not antiseptic. It's ugly and obscene because sin is ugly and obscene. It's ugly and obscene because the innocent one was slaughtered for the guilty. The question is, why? Why did Christ suffer and die? Why did he have to bear our sin? Why the cross? That's an important question. That's a question you and I need to be able to answer. Why the atonement? Last time we defined atonement as the means by which God's holy wrath is satisfied and sinful men are brought back into right relationship with God. The atonement is how God's holy, righteous wrath is satisfied. And the key words are substitute and satisfaction. There is one who stood in our place. There is one who bore our sin. There is one who bore our judgment, our substitute. He stood in for us. And the other thing is he satisfied God's demand. God's righteousness was satisfied in Christ. He is our propitiation, and that's another theological term that we don't use much anymore, but it's an important word because it means to turn away God's wrath. It means to appease God's wrath. And there are those who don't like that word. There are those who think that we're doing an injustice to God if we use the language of propitiation, because how dare we say God's wrath had to be appeased? Well, it does. Because God's wrath is real, and God's wrath is righteous, and it must be met. God is holy and righteous and just, and therefore judgment had to come. We also talked about three types of theology. Augustinianism, which says salvation is by grace alone. Semi-Pelagianism, which says it is our works in cooperation with the grace of God. And Pelagianism, which says salvation can be achieved apart from the grace of God. That by our own goodness, our own inherent goodness, through our own acts of self-sacrifice and through our own righteousness that we can be saved, we don't need the grace of God. And each of those has their own view of the atonement. Pelagianism, as you might expect, says that atonement is absolutely unnecessary. There is no reason for it. There is no reason for the death of Christ. It didn't accomplish anything as far as our salvation. what that group thinks and that school teaches is that the death of Christ did happen. Christ did die. He did suffer on the cross. And it sets a wonderful example for us of sacrifice. It sets a wonderful example for us of loving and caring for others, that you would be willing to go through that. But it's not necessary for atonement. Semi-Pelagianism says that the atonement is hypothetically necessary, meaning that God could have saved us any number of ways, but the way God chose to save us was through sacrifice. And when God chose that as the way He was going to do it, then it does become necessary. It's necessary because that's the way He chose to do it. That God chose one of the many means available. The other view, Augustinianism, says that the atonement is absolutely necessary. And I believe that's the biblical position. It's not theoretically or hypothetically necessary. It is absolutely necessary. It's not one of the options that God had. It is the only option. So we must understand why it's the only option. Why it had to be. Why is it absolutely necessary? And we're going to begin answering that question this evening. And let me give you the short answer. The short answer is this: God's justice demands it. That's why the cross was necessary. That's why Christ had to suffer. That's why He had to die. That's why He had to shed His blood, because God's justice demands it. Our starting point in dealing with the question of why is God. We have to begin with God, because when we deal with any question related to salvation, our starting point is God. It's not us. It's not our need. It's God. It's His character. It's His nature. That is always the beginning point. God is holy and God is righteous. God is absolutely pure. He is undefiled. He is altogether righteous, and He is altogether just. That's where we start, with the character of God. Okay, I just said God is altogether righteous and altogether just, but I thought He is love. He is. And because He is love, because that is part of the essence and character of God, because that permeates everything else, we have to understand that as a pure and holy and righteous person, His love is pure and holy and righteous and just. And so He must, if He's going to be God and pure and holy and right and all of those things, there is something that He must love supremely. And what He must love supremely is that which is most deserving of His love, which is Himself. Again, that sounds bad, because if you said that about you, or if I said that about me, we'd just laugh and shake our head and say, well, that is so wrong. And because I'm sinful, because I'm corrupt, because I'm impure. But God, who is absolutely pure and right, is the most lovely thing in all of the universe. And so God loves Himself supremely. And His righteousness and His justice and His righteous judgment must be satisfied. The problem is, when you and I think about the cross and what motivated God to send the Lord Jesus to die for us, we think first of His love and His mercy. In doing so, we often overlook the characteristic that makes the atonement absolutely necessary, and that is His justice. If salvation is a matter of grace, if it is an undeserved, unearned gift, if it is dependent upon His mercy, okay, grace is God's giving to us what we do not deserve, right? Mercy is God's not giving to us what we do deserve. And if grace and mercy are involved in salvation, then that has to mean that God's justice has been violated by someone, and something has to be done in order to meet His justice. We have to begin with the character of God, with His just and righteous nature. Yes, God is loving and God is merciful. And yes, thank God He pardons sinners and is gracious and merciful to us, but not at the expense of His justice. In being loving and merciful, He does not deny His just and righteous nature. I've heard people say, why couldn't God just forgive? If He did, He violates justice. He does an unjust thing. He's involved in injustice, which violates His nature, which violates His character. The first person to formally argue this was a medieval monk by the name of Anselm. He wrote a little book called Why the God-Man, in trying to explain why God came in flesh, or God came incarnate in the person of Christ. He argued that in order to understand the necessity of both the incarnation and the crucifixion, we had to understand God's justice. So we need to talk about that. We need to understand that from a biblical perspective, in the Old Testament, as you look and read the Old Testament, in the Jewish mind, justice was never abstract. It was never thought of in abstract terms out here away from us. It was thought in terms of doing what is right. In the Old Testament, justice is always linked with righteousness. Righteousness means to do that which is right. Therefore, God's justice has to do with His internal righteousness. It has to do with His character, which defines everything that He does. God can never be found to have engaged in an injustice. He never violates His righteous standard in anything that He does. So let me give you a simple definition of God's justice. God's justice is His eternal, unchanging commitment to always do what is right. God's justice, His eternal, unchanging commitment to always do what is right. Now, to help us understand that, let's turn to Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter 18. Remember, the context is that Abraham has some visitors that come to see him. Three men come to visit him, and he asks them to turn aside and come to his tent. And they finally agree to it, and they come, and he has them a meal for them and has food brought to them. And in the course of the conversation, the spokesman of the group says, I'll be back here next year at this time, and I want to see that son of yours. What son? The one you're going to have between now and this time next year. And you remember what Sarah did? She laughed. Because she said, that boat's already sailed. I'm way past the time when women bear children. That can't be. That's impossible. And Abraham agreed. And the strange visitor said, no, you will have a child by this time next year. Now, we pick up the story in verse 16. Genesis 18 and verse 16. Then the men set out from there, and they looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to set them on their way. The Lord said, Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. So they're going on their way, and they make it clear that they're on their way to Sodom. And Abraham goes with them to see them on their way. Now, Sodom and Gomorrah were vile, wicked, and corrupt cities. Their name, even to this day, represent corruption and perversion. When someone accuses a city or a place being like Sodom and Gomorrah, they're not saying wonderful place to vacation. They're saying that's a wicked, corrupt place. That is a vile place. You don't want to hang out there. You don't want to go there. You don't want to be a part of that because it is corrupt. It is vile. It is a wicked place. So God seems to be weighing. Well, should I tell him or should I not? But the biblical writer is using language to help us understand. God knew what he was going to do. God is all-knowing. He wasn't weighing about whether he should let him know or not. He's going to tell him. And why is he going to tell him? Because God has already said he's going to make a great nation of Abraham. And God did not choose Abraham and thus the Jewish people arbitrarily. He didn't just on a whim say, I don't know, let's take them and then I'll just call them my people. He had a purpose in it all. Notice what the purpose is in verse 19. It was to create a nation that will be holy, that will be set apart, a people who will bear witness to the character of God by imitating him in the pursuit of righteousness and justice. They were to be a picture of God himself. And when you read all of those regulations in the Old Testament, all the dietary laws and all those kinds of things, it was to make them different from all the peoples around them. It was to set them apart as being different and distinct. They were to be other. They were to be a holy presence. They were to be a people who reflect the character of God. Now they failed at it often, and often failed miserably. But the purpose in selecting them was for them to be a picture of God. They were to reflect God's attitudes. They were to reflect God's character. They were to reflect God's perspective on the world. So God decides he's going to tell him what he's going to do, beginning in verse 20. The Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come up to me. If not, I will know. Now again, God isn't saying, well, I've gotten these reports and I've got to go check it out for myself, so I'm on a little fact-finding mission. God knows everything. He knows that the reports are true. And he's going down in judgment. Abraham knows that. How do we know that Abraham knows it? Because of what Abraham does next. When God says, I'm going down there, he means I'm going down there in judgment. He's saying, I'm going down because the reports are true. I am going to go down and visit them with my holy judgment. So, the men turned, verse 22, from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. Abraham drew near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? So see, he knows he's going in judgment. He knows that the righteous judgment of God is about to fall on the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. So he asks a question. Now, it is an interesting question. Because if you know anything about the character of God, if you know anything about God's nature, then to ask this question is to answer it. Look at the question again. Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Of course not. A holy, just, and righteous God is not going to destroy the righteous along with the wicked. That would be injustice. Now, all of us had an experience at school, whether it was with a teacher or a coach, when something happened and the teacher didn't know who did it, the coach didn't know who did it, and so they say, whoever did this needs to come up here and confess it. And nobody went to confess it. And nobody in the class ratted them out. And all of us had that experience where the teacher or coach said, all right, all of you are going to have this punishment. You know, I remember times at practice when the coach said, well, since nobody's owned up to this, everybody's going to run, get on the line, and everybody had to run, the innocent and the guilty. There have been times when a teacher said, none of you get to go out and play because somebody did this and they won't own up to it, so I'm going to have to punish all of you. Now, that might be effective. It might be practical. But it's not just. And it isn't right. Because there are innocent people being punished. You see, there are people in the class who knew who did it. Or there are people on the team who knew who was guilty. But there are also those others, they have no idea who did it. They are innocent. And to punish them the same as the guilty is not a just thing to do. It's an unjust thing. It is an injustice to the innocent. God's not a frustrated teacher. God's not a frustrated coach. He knows who the guilty and the innocent are. He has no trouble separating the two. He has no trouble understanding who did what. So to punish the innocent along with the guilty would not be righteous. It would be an act of great evil. So, Abraham asks the question, and then he starts to bargain. Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Then hear the next question, or the next statement. Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be it from you, here's the question, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? Or shall not the judge of all the earth do what is right? Of course he will. Because he doesn't know how to do anything else. Just like it's impossible for God to lie, it's impossible for God to do injustice. Because it violates his character. It violates his nature. So, what does God say? How does God answer him? Verse 26, the Lord said, if I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake. If you find 50 righteous, will you destroy the whole place, the 50 righteous and all the others? Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do what is right? God says, well, you got me there. Yeah. I'll do what's right. In fact, I'll do you one better. If I can find 50 righteous in that city, I'll not only spare the 50 righteous and deliver them, I'll let the guilty go. I'll be gracious and merciful, even to the guilty. We're proud of our legal system. Because what do we demand? Well, you're presumed innocent. The state has to prove you guilty. The state has to prove you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, why do we do that? Because our system is structured to seek, and I'm talking about in theory, because we all know there are problems and it always doesn't work according to theory, but in theory, it's because we want to protect the innocent. And so we say, since we are sinful, fallen people, since we don't always know with absolute certainty who the guilty are, we choose to err on the side of clemency. We choose to err on the side of letting a guilty person go free rather than punish an innocent. Abraham is pleased with the news, but he's not satisfied. So he continues, and you read on from verse 27 on down. You know the story. He bargains and bargains and bargains, and God keeps saying, okay, okay, till finally he gets it down to 10 and says, so if you find 10 righteous, will you spare the city? All right, if I find 10 righteous, I'll spare the city. What happened? There were not 10 righteous in Sodom. And so God's judgment fell. His judgment fell not because God is cruel, not because He's harsh, not because He's lacking in love. It fell because God is just and righteous, and justice demands judgment. By all rights, the judgment of Sodom should have been the judgment of the entire human race. Because not only was God not able to find 10 righteous people in Sodom, He couldn't find 10 righteous people on the earth. Because what does Romans tell us? Romans 3. There is none righteous. No, not even one. We have all offended God's holy standard. We have all violated His law. And thus we are all deserving of His judgment. So, why is the atonement necessary? Because God's character demands it. Because He is holy and He is just. And because He is holy and just, He cannot excuse our sin. He must pass judgment on it. The judge of all the earth must do what is right. To put it in practical terms, what would you do? How would you react if a serial killer who all the evidence makes it clear and there's the chain of evidence is kept and everybody knows it is the correct evidence and this is the person and all of the necessary things are met. He's guilty. There's no question about it. And he's even pronounced guilty if a judge said, but that's no big deal. Go on. What would the reaction be? We would all scream, no. We certainly wouldn't applaud the judge and say, what a caring, gracious man. We would say, what about these victims? What about these families? We all understand, we all know that wickedness and sin and evil must be punished. We just don't want that to be true when we're talking about us. But as long as we can talk about it in the realm of theory, yeah. God's holy. And because He's holy, He must. It's not an option. He must punish sin. Therefore, God in His holy, righteous character must punish sinners or provide a way to atone for their sin. Cross is absolutely necessary. Not just in theory. Not just in saying, well, that's one way of looking at it. It's the only way to look at it. If He is holy, and if He's righteous, and if He must always, eternally, consistently, purposefully do that which is right, then sin has to be punished. His judgment must fall. Either on the guilty party, or some form of atonement must be made in their behalf. That's why we say it is absolutely necessary.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.